Good afternoon. I think we're past morning now. It's been a long day for the court, but thank you for appearing on our Zoom platform at the Court of Appeals. I want to remind you that despite the mechanism that you're arguing from today, that the rules of appellate procedure remain in place. When it is your turn to speak, please introduce yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of. We also have a timer appearing in the upper left-hand corner. Each of you has 15 minutes to present your case in chief and the argument supporting it, and 5 minutes will be reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose that feature. Now, with that said, I'm going to have our marshal call the last Zoom matter for consideration.
Now calling case number A220142, Allison Lee Henry versus Peter Jason Malan.
And appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, you may. I do want both of the attorneys to know that this is a very lengthy record as far as the proceedings and that the judges are well apprised of the history of this case. So you can get into the nitty gritty of it and not spend so much time on the factual orientation.
Thank you, Your Honors. I represent Peter Malan, the appellant. Here, this is an unusual case in that there was a hearing held on April 26, 2021, where referee Knight denied relocation. And then a mere few months later, August 18, 2021, announced from the bench that the relocation motion was granted. Procedurally, there was a motion brought essentially 12 days after the written findings came down. This is a case where the court abuses discretion. I think both counsels agree as to what the standard of review on the relocation is.
But abuse of discretion doesn't rest on the fact that the judge may have changed his or her mind. Having been a trial court judge, there's a lot of times that after greater reflection, you may come around to a different thought processes in terms of what would be best, the best fit for this family. These are complex cases. So are you arguing that because the mere fact that the referee in this case went a different course, that is a basis for a reversal?
What we're arguing is considering these facts and how they played out, I agree that a court has the ability to change its mind. But I think the way that the court changed its mind here is really how the discretion was abused. The only factor that changed was that he married Mr. Henry. Miss Anderson married Mr. Henry, and she did that in June after we had discussed things and had actually not come out in the initial pleadings for the April hearing. I think where that's important is that a lot of the underpinnings of the ruling relies on the things like the first ruling talks about all financial security, those sorts of things is dependent upon Mr. Henry. And I think if you look at addendum 31 page 32, the court shares father's concern that Mary's move is based on her desire to be with her significant other. Although her mother contends her new relationship is mature and settled, the court is concerned that the children are a secondary decision in her decision to relocate. And when we get to the next hearing, she still has a concern about the decision to relocate. Really, the only factor that changed is that she married Mr. Milan, Mr. Henry. And it's dependent, really, all the same dependency still exists. She is dependent on him for financial support. She's dependent upon him for housing, all of those sorts of things, dependent on him for a job. Nothing really changed other than she married Mr. Henry. Respondent argues that there's a significant connection. The argument is that there's a significant connection because they are married.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is that the classification of marriage was unjustifiably promoted in support of the move. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, I think
and,
that. The,
and my yes, question then to you is this: it appears from these parents can't find a lot of favor with each other, as is reflected not only in the referee's order and previous orders, but it's also in the affidavits. And in some context, your client appeared to take issue with the fact that she moved to Duluth and wasn't married. So you can't really have it both ways.
Well, I disagree a little bit with that characterization. If you look at the procedural history of the case, she moved to Duluth. Yes, that happened earlier on in the case. But Mr. Milan moved his therapist practice and moved up to Duluth to be with the children. So, ultimately, he conformed his behavior and promote and to have more parenting time with the kids. And he moved to Duluth to do that. Run this a long time. I can't tell you.
And I do say that that speaks admirably of your client, both as a father as well as just an above the board parent. That's one of his better qualities.
Right. And I think that's part of the considerations when you look at the best, the factors that are laid out in the relocation factors is that when they were in Duluth, they had, especially during the pandemic, there was a relationship with both of the children that was Arlo and Greta, that was active, that was spontaneous. And when there is a move to Amory, essentially those things go away. And there's not the ability to have that type of parenting time arrangement. And there, and in April, the court kind of recognized that and wanted to continue to promote that relationship, because really what we're looking at is a best interest type analysis with the relocation factors, and that we want to be able to continue to have that type of relationship, which I think based upon the move to Amory, that really makes that very difficult. Where Mr. Milan then is put in a position where he's responding to what happened in terms of the move. And I think the legislative history is really important here. If you look at the relocation statute, I mean, there 2006 or 2007, I can remember a day that's earlier on in my practice that what parties would do is you'd move to Nebraska. And then the presumption was that you could do that, and then the parent would be challenging the move to Nebraska. You'd be saying, well, this is inappropriate. The legislature in 2006, 2007 flipped that presumption, and they made it so that prior to a move, there had to be permission. And that was a significant change in the law at that particular time, because that was a change in how the courts really look relocation. I think that's important here to kind of look at, because essentially what we have here is a case, it feels like a 2005 relocation motion where one party just moved. Essentially, she moved to Zimmerman and she did things to essentially force the court's hand. And none of the underlying circumstances changed. And because of that, we think it's appropriate that this is an abuse of discretion and the court's decision should be reversed. The kids, it was inappropriate to have a relocation decision that was issued here. So that is kind of the basis for the abuse of discretion, is if you kind of think about it historically.
The district court found that the record was unclear, that the children that are affected, the I think 16 and 13-year-old, they didn't express a preference. Can you give me any background on that? I couldn't discern that from the record.
I don't think that there's really a clear expression of preference. I mean, I think that if you look at the record, that the fact that the kids spent significant time, Arlo and Greta, spent significant time with dad, really bespeaks to their preference. And the problem with preference, just from having done it, is it's so easily malleable. especially in a high conflict case. I mean, if I'm trying to ask a child what they think, excuse me, Your Honor, a 16-year-old child, and they're asked in the context of the litigation, I mean, they're going to say what they're going to need to say. I think behavior.
I was the attorney that represented Mrs. Ross on the Ross versus Ross case, and I'm still feeling a little unfettered by that decision. So yes, I agree with you. But was there no request by either attorney to have the children state a preference?
There was no request by either attorney to state a preference, and I from a practice perspective, I don't like to do that. I think behavior here really indicates what the kids feel. You know, obviously, if you think about it from the kids' perspective, they're all of a sudden, they find out that mom is dating a new person, whom she is going to marry. And then we're all of a sudden going to move from Duluth to Amory. And then daughter is going to be placed in boarding school in St. John's. That's a really difficult situation for children to find themselves in. And that in and of itself, I don't think that the court really did any examination of that. It felt in the second decision that referee Knight felt that her hand was forced. And I don't think that's an appropriate use of discretion. I mean, there's a voluminous record here and really nothing substantially changed other than the marriage to Peter Henry. And I think if you look at everything, it was always a high conflict case. I mean, if you just, the record is voluminous here. There's been to court numerous times. It's always been a high conflict case. So the proximity decision there, I mean, that really didn't change. I mean, this is one of those family law cases where the parties have gone to court and there's a lot of conflict. And that's just the kind of the way it is. It just felt in this particular case, my problem with it is the decision was forced upon the court, that the court didn't really have a choice. And it felt like a motion that was brought. Essentially, I sort of felt when looking at this case that the way to handle some cases is just to say, hey, you know, let's do what we need to do to have this happen. And I don't think that's the appropriate way. So that, you know, our feeling on that is because of that, the relocation decision should be reversed. I don't think there's any necessary, in terms of a remedy, I don't think the court here needs to remand it. I mean, there's a large record. I think that the decision could and should be reversed. Mr. Milan remains in Duluth. And there's no reason why Miss Henry can't find a job. I mean, all of those circumstances existed at the time. Just briefly, Your Honors, I'd like to touch on the endangerment, persistent interference with parenting time, if the court would like me to move there. I think in this particular case that there is, that the court failed to consider the allegations as true, especially as to the persistent and willful denial of parenting time. I think on that basis, and the court has the ability here to review that de novo, I think on that basis that there should be an evidentiary hearing granted. And I think really just kind of the dynamics of the case really support it, is that there's basically these kids are kind of caught in the middle of whatever Miss Henry's goals in life, and she's attached to a person that is a new relationship. And there's really no consideration of whether, you know, all of Mr. Henry, any of those sorts of things. So we think that in this particular case, that there was not a finding that's sufficient for that there should be an endangerment hearing granted, and that there was willful interference. For any other questions, I have nothing further.
It appears not. We'll turn to respondent counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Thomas Witt. I'm the attorney representing Allison Henry, who's the respondent before this court and was the petitioner below. I think we basically have, as Mr. Laufer said, two distinct issues in this case. The first is whether the court abused its discretion on the motion to relocate. I think in their memorandum, they phrase it as when the only thing that changed was that Ms. Henry got married. I think, first of all, that statement actually answers itself. There were some changes. It wasn't just an arbitrary change of situation. If you look at the April 26th order and the July written order that followed it, the court placed most of its emphasis on the fact that it was concerned about maybe a sudden end to the relationship. It was concerned about a prior failed business with a boyfriend. However, the marriage, first of all, by virtue of being a marriage, it shows a greater level of commitment by both parties and a greater permanency. And I think when we're looking at an abuse of discretion standard, the court can find that significant. The second thing is, in getting married, as laid out in her affidavit, what changed is, as part of the marital property agreement, she gained an ownership interest in Dragonfly Gardens. She wasn't working for Mr. Henry anymore. She was working for herself. She also gained an ownership interest in the real property. So in the event the marriage happened to fail, she had a significant financial interest in Amory and significant financial security that she did not have at the time of the April 26th hearing. And I think that's significant. I think it's also significant when you look at this case that the judge had some additional information, additional interaction between the parents, and the court made a couple of findings that I think were relevant. One, I'm kind of stepping back a little, but as part of the marriage, the court also noted that the court felt it was in the best interest of the children, rather than Ms. Henry and Mr. Henry living apart, if the children could be together with Mr. Henry and Ms. Henry in a marital home, that would provide greater stability than Mr. Henry and Ms. Henry maintaining separate residences. As is established in the record, you know, Mr. Henry's businesses, finances, real estate are all in Amory, so it would be difficult not to have a split household. The second thing is the court, with this additional information on the record, also noted that, you know, based on how things had gone over the summer, it appeared to the court that, quite frankly, the children would probably benefit from the parents not residing in the same city. That would allow the children to have clear boundaries. They couldn't just leave Mr. Milan's house and walk over to Ms. Henry's house. I think she showed with the July incident in the record that she wasn't, if the kids called and said, we want to go home, she wasn't just going to say, okay, I'll come pick you up. You know, she was respecting Mr. Milan's parenting time. And therefore, I think, you know, Mr. Laufer's kind of asked the court to reweigh the evidence and not only remand for an additional finding, but for the court to essentially pretty much almost change custody on appeal. I think if you look at the court's record, the court went through all of the best interest factors. The court clearly placed the burden of proof on Ms. Henry, and it made a decision when there were
right,
facts.
Then here's my question for you, Mr. Witt. Best interest factors. So what about a child's preference? I'm just curious where that kind of fell apart, or if you take the same position that it's lends to children being manipulative.
So I think what the record will say is Ms. Henry believes that the children prefer to live with her, and that's what they'd say. Mr. Henry presented some information that the children kind of wanted to stay with him, although mostly that was Greta, and we think that was tied to a boyfriend. There was some information in the record, but it wasn't clear. But we did not feel that, I think I would agree, we didn't feel it was in the best interest to necessarily, well, sorry, let me think about that for a second. I guess what I would say is, I think in this case, it's not a decisive factor. I think it is a factor. I think the record would have been, I think the record would have actually been in my favor based on what's in there. But had the children said, well, our preference is to live with Mr. Milan, I don't think that would change the results. So I don't think it was something that was necessary to make a decision. Because what we don't have in the record is we don't have the record, anything from Mr. Milan saying, oh, the children have indicated this will be horrible. They don't want, they think it's going to be awful. They're going to run away. We have some indication.
Right. I understand there's not a reasonable preference. The basis for my question was that when she moved to Amory, that Noah stayed behind, and that seemed to be decision-making. So, I mean, if there's nothing in the record and there's no determination by the court, then we'll go no further with that.
Okay. And then I'll just note that, of course, Noah is an entirely separate case because by the time this was brought, he was essentially independent. So it's a different situation. So anyways, on that issue, I think the court should affirm, because while I think maybe a different judge would have made a different decision, I think the court issued a well-reasoned decision that looked at the facts in the case, and nothing's been pointed to in the record that the court ignored. And then,
so Mr. Witt, the judge made some statement that he felt your client was forcing his or her hand. Had your client already relocated with the children to Wisconsin after the original denial of the motion to relocate?
No, she had not. What had gone on that summer is essentially the kids were at summer camp. The children are with Mr. Milan. The reason she brought the motion when she did is obviously the lease expired in Duluth. She was looking for a place to live, but she was very carefully and deliberately not telling the children their house was Amory. She was very carefully not moving the children in there. And of course, since they spent significant time with Mr. Milan, she had not relocated. She was very careful not to relocate. Her housing was in flux. And I think if you look at the record of the hearing, she said, you know, the court will make its decision and I will follow it, whatever it is. I'm waiting for the court's decision to finalize where I'm going to live. I think that's where she was and that when she brought the motion. And I think that's in the record.
Judge Flory.
I just thought, despite apparently she'd sent Mr. Milan an email giving an Amory, Wisconsin address that summer.
Right. And that was the best mailing address for her because, well, one, she didn't have a permanent address at that point. She was waiting for the court's determination. And two, of course, any mail sent to Amory is mail she would get. Obviously, when the children are with Mr. Milan, it made sense for her to stay with Mr. Henry. That's also where the Dragonfly Gardens were. So it was a good mailing address. It was a good place to get into contact with her.
So up until, I think that the hearing where the motion was granted to allow relocation was August 18th. So over that summer, Mom was not living. I was just wondering, where were the kids spending the night? Were they away camps forever? Or were they, I mean, I just.
It was,
they went on. Did she have them overnight over the summer?
They went on vacation and traveled. They had 2 weeks of overnight camp. I'd have to look at the schedule. I don't have it in front of me. I know certainly until they got back in August, I think then they went on vacation in August. I certainly can't say they never spent any time in Amory. They might have, but I don't think it was, you know, it wasn't they were going to Amory, going to Mr. Milan's, going back to Amory. It was they were going to camp. They were visiting Mr. Milan. They were going on vacation. They were visiting Mr. Milan.
Staying overnight in Amory.
And maybe at times staying overnight at Amory, but I don't think it was they spent their summer there. I think it was one of the places they stayed, but in addition to traveling, obviously they were in Duluth through June. So we're really talking more July, August. And then they had the camps and the vacation.
I guess I'm just asking, because if they spent time at Amory, presumably it's because that's where Mom is. So didn't she, in fact, relocate then to Amory? Why would the kids be staying in Amory before the motion was granted if Mom hadn't relocated there?
Because during the, because at that time, Mom did not have a lease. She had to pick where she was going to relocate. She had a pending motion in order to determine where she was going to establish permanent residency. If you go on vacation in Florida, even if you go and visit grandma for 3 weeks, that's not a relocation necessarily. What matters is whether or not it's, you know, a permanent intention to remove the children there, regardless of the court's order. And I don't think we have that because we had the motion filed and the request and this clear statement that she was waiting to move. But I think there's, at some point she had to stay somewhere. They could have maybe stayed in a tent in Duluth or anywhere in Minnesota, but that wouldn't necessarily have been in the children's best interest. But I think the fact that there was a pending motion is a critical factor in determining that she wasn't, you know, that it, when she says it was temporary, we also know it was temporary because we had this motion pending. Obviously if the judge had denied it and then we find out a week later, the children have been enrolled in Amory schools, and they're going to Amory schools after an express order on August 18th, it would be a little different. One of the reasons we had the hearing and August 18th, and we pushed for that date, and the court issued an order on the record, is because, you know, the summer is a little different than the school year. You can be a little more loosey-goosey with your residents because there's not that permanency yet. And then obviously part of what she did is enroll Greta in the boarding school because one, Greta had expressed an interest in that, and two, that helped provide some stability there. I mean, ultimately Greta decided she didn't like it. So that's not really an issue here, but I think the fact that it was the summer and not the school year is significant. And the fact that there's a pending motion is significant. And the fact that she went out of her way that while she stayed there, the children generally didn't. That was not their home. Their stuff was in storage until the court's decision was reached. And then, you know, going into the second part of, I mean, and even then, of course, that doesn't change whether or not the court abused its discretion in deciding to grant the relocation motion. The court would probably could have viewed that as a negative factor, but it doesn't automatically reverse a decision on relocation. Now, it can be a basis for a motion to change custody if you can establish all the other factors, but the court, I think, reasonably made a finding that that wasn't happening and that really wasn't argued because she hadn't established and there was nothing in the record saying she'd establish a permanent household. You know, turning quickly to the second part of this, which is whether or not the court ignored, and this is a second motion, so I think you can affirm the first one and remand the second if you had to, although I think the decision on the motion on the endangerment and change of custody motion should also be affirmed, because ultimately, if you look at the record, what the district court said is it had reviewed all of the pleadings and there was nothing in the pleadings or in the record that would support a change in custody. The court in its written order specifically said there was no prima facie case of endangerment that would support a change of custody. If you look at the statute, you know, he has to show a couple of things. First, he has to show endangerment. None of the allegations in the affidavits rise to that level. He says in his own affidavit, the children came over. He had communications with the children. He was texting with the children. They weren't being alienated from him. Sometimes they didn't want to visit, but by his own testimony, he actually underplayed any conflict. You know, taking his affidavit as true, the children still had a relationship with him. He wasn't being alienated. You know, endangerment is a relatively undefined term, but as the court said in Goldman, it at least means a significant danger. Here, the allegations are essentially she's too permissive. She doesn't do enough to force the children to spend time with their dad. And that maybe when the children say, oh, I argue all the time with the dad, maybe she says, yeah, he can be difficult sometimes. But what she doesn't say is, well, that's an excuse not to spend time with your father. There's nothing other than conclusory allegations that even establish that she did anything but what she could to support visitation. Even if you take every conclusory allegation as true, it doesn't rise to the level of endangerment. We see the parenting time continue in this case. We also see, you know, even if there was some technical endangerment, the court also has to find that the change in custody is in the best interest of the children and the change outweighs the harm to the children. Ms. Henry had been the sole legal and physical custodian for at least the past 5 years. Mr. Henry, up until recently, had only court-ordered limited weekend parenting time and then some informal parenting time during the weeks that was not in the order. And now he's at a point where his court-ordered parenting time following this hearing is more than he had under the prior order. It's been substantially increased. In effect, he hasn't actually lost any parenting time he's exercised. And ultimately, though, there's nothing in the record that shows it would be in the best interest of the children to change custody from the mother who's had sole legal and sole physical custody from 5 years and go and uproot them from the household they've lived in and the parent they've resided with. And I think nothing in Mr. Milan's affidavits would rise to that level. Even if you were to find the court ignored the affidavits would still support the judge's finding that, or Mr. Milan's affidavit specifically would still support the finding that it is not in the children's best interest to change custody and force them to live with Mr. Milan. And for that reason, I think it was appropriate not to order an evidentiary hearing because even assuming the testimony proved everything he said in his affidavit, nothing would change. I think I have 3 seconds left, so I'm going to stop there.
And now you're out of time. So thank you, Mr. Witt. We'll turn back to you, Mr. Loffers. You have the last word.
I think turning just briefly to the issue regarding the relocation, the record does show that she remarried Mr. Henry in June. So the record shows that there was a remarriage in June, and Mr. Henry runs a greenhouse business. So I think it's a pretty fair inference from the facts that Miss Henry was living in Amory most of the time, probably with the kids in a greenhouse business, because from my knowledge of greenhouse businesses, they are more active in the summer. And I think that's really indicative of essentially the court's hand being forced. She essentially defied a court order and forced the court's hand without any significant changes. I think the other thing, the marital property agreement that Mr. Witt cites as a Wisconsin marital property as suggesting a major financial interest, I think there's a couple things to note with that. I have the benefit that I actually maintained an active practice in Wisconsin. I'm right on the border. So I have a lot of Wisconsin cases. Number one, the marital property agreement wasn't attached. When a marital property agreement, in my experience, is filed and used to help deal with the community property on which Wisconsin divides property. Wisconsin is not an equitable division state. Wisconsin is a community property state, which means that there's an equal presumption that property is divided. So a marital property agreement may indeed provide less, and we don't know that.
That may in fact be true, but you know, to both of you, we're a reviewing court, and I'm not trying to shuck any responsibility by the Court of Appeals, but we review whether the referee, the trial court, abused its discretion. And the argument that I'm hearing coming is that the court felt that you're arguing that the court felt that its hands were tied, but that would be expecting us as an appellate court to say the court was under duress. I mean, the power and the muscle of this would have been at the trial court level. Tell me how we could meet your client's objectives when we're reviewing for an abuse of discretion, short of saying that the trial court did not, I guess, felt threatened or felt that it was powerless.
Well, I think that abuse of discretion doesn't mean that appellate court doesn't have the ability to reverse a decision if there's a definite and firm conviction based upon the facts that the lower court made a mistake. That's what the law says. So I think it doesn't say that the reviewing court can never change a decision. It simply says there has to be a definite and firm conviction. And I understand that doesn't happen very often. But I think this is a setup where that is the case. We don't often have a setup like this. Usually what you're doing is you're arguing, well, this is, you know, I don't like how the judge made this decision. And we're arguing over the finer points. That's usually what an abuse of discretion comes down to.
Does this case in any way lend itself to a precedential determination by this court?
Well, I mean, I think it is unique enough that it helped kind of define, from my perspective, what an abuse of discretion is, because that isn't really well defined within the case law. I mean, it's sort of kind of an example, sort of it feels like a when you see it type example. But this is kind of an example that shows what it might be. I mean, this is essentially, it feels like we threw everything into a hat and we changed one element, and then the court made a different decision. So I do think there is some value for family law practitioners to have a sense of what an abuse of discretion is. Because I can tell you from doing it in a while, one of the problems it feels like there's nothing, you know, we never know what that is. What is an abuse of discretion? I think that would be helpful in this particular case, because I think here, this is an instance where that happened. And if the court issued a decision that said, this is what it is, I think that would be helpful. But I have nothing further if there's no additional questions.
It appears not. I want to thank both of you for coming today and presenting your arguments, which are definitely helpful. The matter is submitted, which means a decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe of 90 days.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
You too.